Hello and welcome to this week's episode of Goals on Film, Edge of the Crowd's dedicated sports movies podcast. I'm your host, Jason, and I've got Stewie with me this week. How have you been doing, Stewie?
Yeah, not too bad. Thanks, mate. Excited to be on the pod. One of my favourite pods that I do. I'm a busy guy with the podcast, but I do love Goals on Film, and I can't wait to get into today's film.
Well, we appreciate you taking time out of your busy schedule each week to appear on this podcast. And I'm sure the listeners do as well with all of your great opinions. And I'm sure that there'll be a couple more tonight.
Absolutely. But
get into the episode now. This week, our film of choice is 1992 baseball comedy drama, A League of Their Own. And we are basically doing this movie because there is a new Amazon Prime series called A League of Their Own. Bit of a spin-off, a bit of a reimagination of this classic movie. And so we thought, why not revisit this 1992 movie? It's a film that tells a mostly fictionalized account of the real-life All-American Girls Professional Baseball League. It begins by following Dottie Hinson in 1988, attending the opening of the All-American Girls Professional Baseball League exhibit at the Baseball Hall of Fame. She sees many of her former teammates and friends, which prompts a flashback to 1943. When World War II threatens to shut down Major League Baseball, Chicago Cubs owner Walter Harvey persuades his fellow owners to bankroll a women's league. Basically, he sends out all these people to scout, look for potential players, and we see a scout called Ernie Cappadino approach Dottie and her sister Kit.
All-timer performance by John Lovitz here, one of my favorite characters of the whole movie. This scout, he's got some great lines in this flick. Sorry, mate, go on.
No worries, we'll definitely get into his character a bit later too. So we see Ernie approach Dottie and Kit, and both of them eventually agree to go. It takes a bit of convincing by Dottie, but they both travel to Harvey Field in Chicago for the tryout. The Peaches are managed by a former star slugger called Jimmy Duggan, who is a cynical alcoholic. He treats the whole thing as a joke and is abrasive towards his players. But, I mean, to get the league up and going and get that support, the players sort of have to take it into their own hands. And the Peaches end up winning the season with the league's best record, qualifying for the World Series. However, that evening, Dottie receives a surprise when Bob, her husband, shows up back from war and basically makes the decision that, she'll leave the game and on the eve of the World Series. But this also prompts Dottie and her sister Kit to go their separate ways in terms of the team, and Kit gets a trade to the Bells. And as luck would have it, the Peaches, Dottie's team, face the Bells, Kit's team, in the World Series. And it goes the full seven games. Dottie, after having quit the team originally, rejoins the Peaches for the seventh game, while Kit is the starting pitcher for the Bells. And with the Bells leading by a run in the top of the ninth, Dottie drives in the go-ahead run. But Kit, distraught, she's the next up to bat. She's got two outs. She's got to get a run in, or two runs in. And she basically hits an inside the park home run. After a play at home plate, where she crashes into her sister, who drops the ball. In the present, Dottie is reunited with the other players, including Kit, as well as Cappadino and Lowenstein, who are both instrumental in starting this league in the first place. And the surviving Peaches, they sing their team song, pose for a photo, as they watch current or former, I should say, All-American League baseball players play out on Doubleday Field. So, Stewie, that was a pretty long synopsis, but I think it gathered everything that you sort of need to know about this movie. What were your takeaways from this movie?
Well, if I could just make a point to our viewers, listeners, this has nothing to do with you. I wasn't bored with Jason's synopsis there. It was fantastic, but I just had to hand out a little bit of discipline to an unruly kitten that's getting around my kitchen right now. Fantastic movie, Jace. Brilliant. Loved every second of it. I was a little bit skeptical that, the hands of time might have diminished the greatness of this film. But, I was saying to you off mic before we were just preparing. 1992, Gina Davis could have been one of the most beautiful women in the world. Tom Hanks is on the verge of one of the greatest acting runs of all time. I mean, after A League of Their Own, he does Philadelphia, Forrest Gump, Apollo 13, just almost unequaled run in film, a couple of best actor awards in there, and he's brilliant in this too. Madonna's an inspired piece of casting. Just the story's beautiful. I've got a few nits to pick, and we'll get to them in due time. But all in all, man, fantastic movie. I had a great time watching it.
Yeah, I think the reason why I like this movie, like, I feel like we've had two really sort of feel-good, feelsy movies in a row now. We obviously had Field of Dreams last week, and yeah, if you haven't listened to that one, go back and listen to it. It was a really good one.
Fantastic episode.
I think
movie.
That, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I think that, yeah, so similarly to that, I think that this movie just like encapsulates so much goodness about baseball itself. You know, like even from one of the first scenes where Dottie is going to Doubleday Field to watch that game, she's like taking everything in. You like get so much of the sounds, you get so much of the excitement, the game itself, the fun of the sport being played essentially. And to me, like that's what sports should be about. So to sort of start off with that, I thought was really good. To sort of just bring it to like a bit of a personal level in terms of, yeah, just like thinking about like how sports should be in like sort of that sort of essence. And then, you know, you get the flashback to 1943 and then just everything that happened with that, and to see like the culmination of what we will get to, you know, a real All-American Girls Professional Baseball League. I think that, yeah, just the way that they told that story, conveyed that story so well on the big screen. I think that they did really well. And, you know, like you even got, yeah, a real sense of just, you know, how much like these women were going through at the time. And, you know, you sort of can relate it back to nowadays as well. I look at, you know, I'm glad like sports haven't really adopted the sort of like sexualization to like sell a product or anything like that. Like, I'm glad that that's not a thing anymore. But I think that in terms of like all the other things that they were saying, you know, like having to play in 100 degree weather, having to ride the bus everywhere, I think that, yeah, you just got a real sense of the time. And yeah, you just sort of had it be brought back to earth and sort of reflect on just how much like this all meant to both like all these people that were involved in this women's league, but then also you as a viewer in terms of thinking about, yeah, just how the sport should be itself.
Yeah, it captures the essence of the sport really well. It captures the time period really well too, I think. I do have a little bit of a problem with old Dottie, the actress. I don't know why they did that. You know what I mean? Like, just slap some old makeup on the actors they're using, right? It would have made more sense. But I guess it could have looked a bit more gimmicky too. But that's neither here nor there. It takes nothing away from the points you were making about how they really get you to, you know, really absorb everything that old Dottie is going through, you know? I thought that was fantastic too.
Yeah. All right, we'll move on now and we will look at history, the historical references of this movie. And I want to start by saying that if not for a 27-minute documentary, this movie would never have existed. And so in 1987, the world had largely forgotten about the All-American Girls Professional Baseball League, but the producer of this movie, Kelly Candiel, and the director, Mary Wilson, were able to bring it back to the public eye with their own short documentary, also titled A League of Their Own, which aired as part of a television series. And fortunately for us, one of the TV viewers was director Penny Marshall. She'd never heard of the league and believed others hadn't either, and the inspiration followed that. So this documentary is obviously the catalyst for the exhibition at the National Baseball Hall of Fame as well, as seen in the end of the movie. So it's really interesting to see that, yeah, just how this movie sort of became an idea.
Yeah, absolutely. That's incredible. You know, another thing, I mean, this might be a bit of a moot point, but I think the timing definitely worked too. Like, if that happened these days, it would definitely be a TV show, which it's going to be. Like, they just don't make movies like this anymore, you know. Everything was in place, and it really was just a, it was a bit of a landmark moment. female director, all female cast, even though Tom Hanks kind of steals the show, you know, it was huge, and it made a ridiculous amount of money at the box office as well.
Well, we'll get into all of that in a bit more, but we'll start off by going back to the 1940s and just seeing how the movie sort of made references to history or sort of like encapsulated that those sorts of moments within history. And if not for World War II, women would never have played baseball. So when the war began, civilians got involved. Among them were Major League Baseball players, and we heard a couple of names in there, such as Joe DiMaggio, Bob Feller. They both joined the fight along with other legend Ted Williams. And more than 500 Major League Baseball players all went to fight in the war. And from that, the All-American Girls Baseball League was formed as a result, since no one knew how long the war would last, nor how many major leaguers would return. And obviously, the league was a huge success. In the movie, curious spectators showed up. I mean, just to see sort of pretty women in short skirts running around. And however, back then as well, fans quickly realized that women are professional level athletes or have the ability to play this sport, which was predominantly played by men. And by the end of the film, the stadiums are full. Historically, public interest in the league also gradually increased, and by the end of the second season, attendance jumped more than 250,000 fans.
Wow, that's really impressive. It's, we're in this moment, or we've been in this moment for the last 10 or 15 years where women's sport is really good, and it seems like we're kind of learning that lesson again, that women can perform at the highest level and be entertaining and, you know, draw crowds and be marketable and all the rest of it. It kind of, when you hear those stats that you just brought out then, that happened during World War II, which at the time of recording was almost 80 years ago. I guess some parts of it was eight, were 80 years, longer than 80 years ago. It's just crazy that it took so long for it to come back around, like the women in sport part of it anyway.
Well, some feared that Major League Baseball would soon be extinct at this point as well. Philip Wrigley, who was the Cubs owner, he had a plan to gradually replace Major League Baseball with his All-American Girls Professional Baseball League if the war raged on. He'd initially hoped to have games on major league fields on off dates and even at night, which was unheard of at the time. But President Roosevelt would not let America's pastime perish. He wrote in 1942, "I honestly feel that it would be best for the country to keep baseball going. There would be fewer people unemployed, and everybody will work longer hours and harder than ever before." So,
That's an interesting take from old Teddy Roosevelt, right? I don't understand how keeping Major League Baseball, what, maybe I just misunderstand what America's favorite pastime is. Is America's favorite pastime the game of baseball, or is it the Major League Baseball that is America's favorite pastime? You know?
Yeah, that's a
Because
good
what's the
question to
difference?
ask.
Yeah, what is the difference? What's he talking about? Anyway, we'll move on. Well, we don't have to unless you got more to add. You're the host, I'm sorry.
That's probably all that I have in terms of like, yeah, that whole, will Major League Baseball continue? Will it move to the Professional Women's League? So we'll move on to another aspect of the times. And that is that black women were not allowed to play. And so, even though Jackie Robinson had broken Major League Baseball's color barrier in 1947, and we'll plug another episode of ours, 42, we did that a few months ago. So, if you haven't listened to that, maybe after Field of Dreams and after this one, you go listen to 42.
Get around it. Have yourself a big old baseball podcast listening party with you and all your friends.
Absolutely. So no woman did in the All-American Girls Professional Baseball League, though not for lack of trying. Mamie Johnson tried out but was turned away. She would later pitch in the Negro Leagues, only one of three women to do so. And fun fact, the movie does reference Johnson. So in a scene where a black woman impressively fires a loose ball back to Dottie, I think it's at one of their games or at the training. Yeah, that was actually Delisa Chin Tyler, who is a retired American softball outfielder. And so she played the role of Johnson, in a way, I guess, which, like, I think was a really good nod to both sort of like Johnson herself and even just like this person that played her in an uncredited role, essentially. So Delisa Chin Tyler, just for that sort of like iconic scene.
It is, you know, Gina Davis, Dottie has like just a bit of a knowing look when she fires the ball back at her, you know, and I just thought that I definitely picked up on that. It's just like a bit of a knowing look on her face when she threw the ball back at her. And I thought that was like just it was a nice nod. There was a lot of good acting going on there where you picked up a lot from that. It was just a simple scene where someone was throwing a loose ball back, but there was just so much more there, and I thought it was just acted and I guess written and directed really well. That's that particular scene. Yeah.
Now, Stuart, you may remember the Peaches' beloved song that they sung throughout the movie. I don't remember the character who first started singing it or composing it, but they all sing it at the end as well.
Honestly, can I just say, like, talk about the biggest moments just to pull you right out of a movie, man. My God. Oh, this is a little known fact about me, okay? Music, unless it's a musical, I'm not against musicals. Actually, don't mind musicals. Very nice. Unless it's a musical, I don't want to see the actors in the movies singing.
Okay.
Just get away from me with that.
Not even if it's Madonna?
Nah, not even Madonna. Just go away. I don't want to see it. Anyway,
go on, Jason. I hope I haven't just shit all over your fact here, by the way.
Sorry if I have.
Okay, well, that's really interesting because, like, as I said at the start as well, where, like, a movie can just, like, take you into such a, like, teary moment. Like, you know, you had your teary moment at the end of Field of Dreams last week.
Yes, absolutely.
You know, like, in a way for me, like, personally as well, like, that final scene where they're unveiling this women's baseball exhibition at the Hall of Fame and where they're all getting together and seeing each other and then they do sing that song, like, this part had me in, like, the verge of tears, so.
Yeah, right. Well, you know, different strokes for different folks, Jace. I'm not going to judge it, but it wasn't for me, man. It wasn't for me.
But coming back to my fact. This anthem, titled The Victory Song, actually predates the film by almost 50 years.
Oh, wow. Okay. Yeah. So what is it from those times? Like, is it from the All-American Girls League?
Yeah.
Yeah, right. Wow.
All-American Girls Professional Baseball League players Nelda Bird Phillips and Pepper Pear Davis wrote the Victory Song, a tribute to the country, the league, its players, and its founder. And yeah, so effectively, like, yeah, these players, part of the league in its first sort of years, or, you know, even before, I guess, they wrote this song. And so it was sort of rehashed and played out and sung in the movie.
All right. Yeah, fascinating. That's crazy.
We'll now move on to looking at sort of the rivalry between Kit and Dottie and I think just sort of how, you know, it was sort of shown in terms of the women playing against each other and just some of the problems that they faced while trying to be professional baseballers as well. And so Kit and Dottie's rivalry is based on the writer's mother and aunt. So Kenny Candiel, who produced that documentary that we talked about at the start, and she shares a story credit on the film. She first conceived the idea for the documentary from his own mother's experience in the All-American Professional Girls Baseball League. So his mother was an outfielder and her sister was a second baseman. And so when it came time to create a fictitious story around the league, it only made sense to him to put a sisterly conflict at the heart of it, and figured out that making them a pitcher and catcher would only increase the tension, which it obviously did.
Yeah, I've got a couple of takes here. One that is my own, that my girlfriend told me I was a monster for even considering. And one I did steal from the legendary Bill Simmons. But is this the time to put in my Dottie and Kit takes?
Yes, yeah, absolutely. Go for it.
Okay. I think there's an argument that could be made that Dottie is a villain in this movie. She holds her sister down at every chance, gets her pulled from the pitching mound a couple of times, calls her out in front of her teammates, isn't really the most traditionally encouraging sister, right? Mm-hmm. But the coup de grace of the whole villainous storyline is her husband comes back. She quits the team on the eve of the World Series, mind you.
Yeah.
Takes off for six games, comes back, drops the ball, costs her team the World Series.
Third, but no, she is not stopping. Keller is running through the stop sign at third. She is not stopping. She ran right through the sign. Here comes the throw. It should be in time. And
villain. That's villain behavior. You have a hard time convincing me otherwise. So that's my original take. Thoughts?
Yeah, I can definitely see how you would come to that conclusion. I think that, just her not wanting to go away in the first place and play baseball, and then sort of only doing it to, you know, ensure that her sister does, because it's her sister's dream more so. And I think, like, we get that as well when, obviously, so we have the scenes of, where Dottie is talking to Jimmy, and Jimmy's like, you know, do you think that Kit can continue pitching this game? And in the end,
yeah,
Dottie's like,
she gets her pulled. Yeah. She's done for.
Yeah.
Also, then, sorry to interrupt you. Also, she gets Kit traded.
Yeah.
She tells the team boss, she says, trade me. She's the fucking star of the league. She's never getting traded. She knew that it was her sister who would get traded. Sorry. Go on.
Yeah, well, that's like the other thing that I wanted to bring up. Like, obviously, like, she didn't intend for her sister to get traded, because she asked for herself to get traded, if that sort of diffused the situation at all, or the tension. And then when Kit realizes, she sort of locks herself in the room and she has 10 minutes to pack. And I think Dottie was just like, you're only in this league because I like agreed to come as well. And I'm just like, that's not the type of thing that you'd say. Like, you know, just.
Where's Dottie?
In there.
Parkland, you want to go to the movies with me?
You want to go with me?
Bitch!
What?
I've been traded to Racine.
You? I told him to trade me.
Oh, yeah, they'd really trade you. Miss Star, Miss Perfect. You know exactly what was going to happen the whole time.
I didn't. This will be better than this.
Come on.
Hey.
I gotta say.
I'll quit, okay? I'll quit. Is that what you want me to do?
Sure, then everybody will blame me for you quitting.
What do you want me to do? I'll do it.
Stay away from me. Just leave me alone. That's what I want you to do.
Kit, listen to me. It was all a mistake, okay? It was a big mistake.
I was getting too good, wasn't I?
You're not listening.
I knew if I did too good, you'd do something to push me down.
Hey, Kit, blow it out your rear end. I am so sick of being blamed for everything that's bothering you. I got you into this league, goddammit.
You got her into the league.
I didn't even want to be here.
Then why are you still here?
Kit wants to know why she's still playing. Why is she still here?
My train leaves at 8 o'clock. I got 10 minutes to pack.
Well, if you have any trouble, you know who to blame.
I'll see you in the World Series.
Yeah, you bet you will.
What an absolute bitch of a thing to say. She's hard, hands down, villain. I called it while I was watching it. So that's my original take.
Yeah.
The legendary Bill Simmons has this take on the Rewatchables podcast. He says that, I think everyone can kind of see it. Kit's kind of shitty a little bit. Mm. Like, she's a whinger. She's annoying. She's got a bit of a Napoleon complex. Everything is her sister's fault. She's tough hang, man. She'd be a tough hang, I reckon.
Yeah, no, I can see that. I can see that.
See, this is the more palatable take. You would have sworn I just agreed to resurrect Hitler when I mentioned my Dottie take to my girlfriend when we were watching it. I'm telling you, man. So, yeah, they're my takes. Anyway, I forgot what segment we're up to. I got too worked up.
We're still in the history segment.
Okay, all right, yep. That final scene, and really the whole thing with old Dottie, right? Her trepidation about even going in the first place.
Yep.
Okay, that kind of rubs me the wrong way. Like, you get it. You sympathize with her in the beginning, right? But then you see her thinking back, and then you see the whole story play out. And then you start thinking, wait a minute, your sister's going to be there, obviously.
Yeah.
Right? So I don't get that. I don't get why she doesn't want to see her sister after all these years. Maybe some stuff happened off camera that we didn't know about between Dottie and Kit. But and then they see each other, and it's supposed to have been 30 or 40 years. And we're supposed to believe that these two sisters, it's the first time they've seen each other since Dottie went home and Kit went to go play more. Yeah. Like, she didn't send her a postcard and say, hey, guess what? You've got some nieces. Or they didn't trade pictures. Or, oh, guess what? I got married. Or, yeah. You know, dad's dead.
I guess Kit never went to Christmases or anything either.
I don't know. How bizarre. Very bizarre. Anyway.
I think that we'll just continue by saying that, you know, Dottie and Kit, they were from farming families. And early in the film, they get approached while they're working on the farm, while they're milking some cows. And they're recruited, offered $75 a week to play for the Peaches. It's not a bad deal when you consider the average wage in the Midwest those days was $40 a week. But in reality, many of the girls did come from farms and farming families, and the players were paid between $55 and $150 a week. The choice between being a farm girl and a pro athlete was a no-brainer for most. It was obviously a chance to make more money and travel the country doing what they loved.
That's incredible. So $150 in the 1940s, that's a decent wage. Yeah. You know, I'm just doing a bit of quick maths. I'm an economics whiz here. And that's worth $3,174.46 in today's money. So that's kind of incredible. Yeah. Really? I want to play for the All-American Girls Baseball League.
Yeah.
Put me in one of them skirts. Let me at them.
Yeah. I mean, I would have just done it. You know, obviously for that reason. But to be a pro athlete, that's some good money then, isn't it?
Absolutely.
And
we're
100% certain that Dottie would have been on that $150 side of things.
Oh, without question. She definitely was. Absolutely. Yeah.
Obviously, we've talked about some players retiring from the sport due to their husbands and wanting to start a family. That really did happen. And similarly, some of the girls at the time as well were actually illiterate. And so we had a scene in the film where a woman was unable to identify her own name on the board of roster cuts. And it's good to see that they sort of both saw, to include, you know, people who were illiterate, similar to the times, and just really harrowed home that aspect of people leaving to start their families and obviously be with their husbands having just returned from the war.
Yeah, absolutely. That scene where she can't read her name on the board.
Hi. Can you read, honey? All right. What's your name?
This is you. You're with us. You're Rockford Peach.
Like, as soon as you see her standing there when all the other girls are gone, you know what's happening, right? You know what's coming. She can't read. One of the other girls is going to, the coach is going to be an asshole. One of the other girls is going to be like, what's the matter? You can't read. And then her name is going to be on the board. It was a Telegraph scene. Doesn't take anything away from it. But as soon as I seen it, I was like, I think I know what's going to happen here.
Yeah. We'll just look at a couple of, so we've talked about like some of the characters being based on other people. And so obviously this is, movie is sort of reflective of the times, but none of the characters' names reflected the real names of actual All-American Girls Professional Baseball League players themselves. Rather, they were based on others or were a composite of people, you know, put together. And so we'll just start on Dottie Hinson. Dottie Hinson was inspired by real-life player Dorothy Cammy Kamenchek. She was a left-handed first baseman and outfielder and was the most feared hitter in the league and a perennial all-star. Her movie counterpart, Dottie, is a right-handed catcher, so a bit of a difference there. But unlike Hinson, who retires after one season in the film, Cammy played for 10 seasons, finishing with an all-time best .292 career batting average, striking out only 81 times. Major League Baseball once called her the finest fielding first baseman, and that included the male players.
Wow. High praise. That's incredible. Yeah, fantastic. Did she have a sister who was a bit of a handful?
I don't believe so. I haven't got that down here, so I don't believe.
Okay. Okay, just thought I'd ask.
Gary Marshall's Walter Harvey character is based on Philip K. Wrigley. So suspecting America's pastime might be a thing of the past with the onset of World War II, Philip K. Wrigley stepped up to the plate. This is in real life. And yeah, he was a chewing gum tycoon, so an eventual owner of the Chicago Cubs. He launched the All-American Girls Professional Baseball League in 1943. Early on in the movie, we learn that Walter Harvey is a chewing gum, or I think it's a chocolate bar magnate, who is trying to start a women's baseball league. And I think this like comes around to the idea that he is based on Philip Wrigley. The tryout scene is filmed on Wrigley Field in Chicago. So it's a nice little nod to the founder of the All-American Girls Professional Baseball League.
Yeah, absolutely. A beautiful homage, some might say.
Mm-hmm. We'll now go on to looking at Jimmy Duggan, who was the manager of the Peaches. He was a composite of two baseball greats. So he is inspired by a pair of real ball players from that era, a mix of Jimmy Fox and Hack Wilson, former icons of the sport who drank themselves out of their careers, so similar to Jimmy Duggan. Jimmy Fox was a three-time MVP. He hit 534 career home runs, won two batting titles and a triple crown. He declined sharply in his mid-30s, in part due to his affinity with booze, and he wound up managing the Fort Wayne Daisies for a season. And so that to me sounds like a lot like Jimmy Duggan.
Absolutely. And, you know, listeners and yourself, Jason, will be surprised to hear that I did a bit of research for this pod too. And I think Jimmy Fox was the one that hit 58 home runs in a season too, right?
Yeah, I believe
yeah.
it.
Look at me adding things to the podcast.
Very nice. We'll just go on to looking. We'll just wrap this up by saying that the Racine Bells won the first championship of the All-American Girls Professional Baseball League. So like they did in the movie. So obviously we talked about in the movie that final play. But the Bells did win the inaugural league in 1943. It wasn't the Peaches that they beat though. So the Kenosha Comets were the team that lost to the Bells in that first year. And so it wasn't the Rockford Peaches. They actually finished dead last.
Okay, wow.
The Peaches didn't stay in last place very long. They were champions in 1945, 1948, 1949, and 1950.
So they turned that slump around. They were just slow starters and then came home with a wet sail.
Yep.
Absolutely. Good for the Peaches.
Yeah. We'll just close this by saying that the fields that they used in the movie, they didn't look like they did in the movie. You know, there's 90 feet between the bases and the distance between the rubber and home plate is 60 feet, 6 inches. The movie abides by this by having the Peaches play on full MLB size fields, whereas the All-American Girls Professional League didn't. In reality, the dimensions resembled softball fields. And over the years, those dimensions grew, but never quite hit MLB standards. And so while the fields got bigger, the balls got smaller, And they were actually using softballs in the early years of this league as well. But by the league's final season, they were hurling baseballs. So,
fantastic. That's incredible.
We obviously saw a few, I think, the scenes in the early on in the movie where a couple of the pitchers were doing the underarm motion. And obviously at the time, many women were playing softball as opposed to baseball. And so women needed to sort of learn how to do the overhead movement that you sort of associate with baseball nowadays and that many baseball pitchers use. Although, yeah, you had some people, I think in the early days of this league, like it was, you were still able to use that underhand motion, but then it sort of like filtered out. And so in the film, as I said, the players threw overhand like baseball pitchers. This style continued until 1946, which was the league's fourth season. That year, a limited sidearm option was adopted, which quickly led to full sidearm throwing. And finally, in 1948, overhand pitching won out, and pitchers threw that way until the league ended.
Crazy.
We'll now look at how the sport was properly depicted throughout the movie. And I think that this sort of like a bit of the historical aspects sort of lead into this as well. And so I'll start off by saying that, I guess, Philip Wrigley, who we talked about a little while ago, he actually demanded that all his girls have a squeaky clean image. And so, you know, in part to combat the lewd public image of female softball players and also to market something entirely fresh, he sought to wipe the slate clean as much as he could, really. And rules were clear and direct. If a player's hair was not at shoulder length or in bobs, she would be fined. If she wore slacks or shorts out in public, she would be fined. If she smoked, drank, or went without makeup, she was fined.
Wow. Tell you what, Philip Wrigley would have a tough time implementing those rules today.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So, wait a minute. You're telling me that All the Way May wouldn't have been, isn't a real character from back in these days?
No.
That's a shame. She was fun. I enjoyed Madonna in this movie.
Go on, sorry.
One other aspect of this, rules and training etiquette from Wrigley was that charm school was a requirement. So you might remember the scene where Dottie and her team learn how to behave like a lady, which includes high tees, posturing. Since most of the girls were athletes and many grew up on farms, proper etiquette was not exactly in their repertoire. And so the league brought in a woman by the name of Helena Rubinstein, who was an owner of a chain of beauty salons, to teach the girls correct posture, how to apply makeup, and even how to woo a date.
Oh my God. It's incredible. My times have changed.
Yeah. We'll move on to, the playing in a skirt. It was no easy task, and the movie demonstrates the risk of playing with bare skin exposed. And Stewie, you have some information on some nasty bruises that some of the actors,
Yeah, I do actually. So thanks to TikTok user at Deontay DJ, I did find out that Penny Marshall, the director, made all the women go through baseball boot camp. They had to try out for a collegiate baseball coach just to prove that they had some baseball skills to build upon to be in the movie. She wanted all the baseball to be authentic. And that means broken bones, concussions, and even that big-ass bruise you see on that girl's thigh in the dugout. It's just on for like a quick second, but that's a real bruise sliding into home plate. One of the horrors of having to wear a skirt playing baseball, I suppose.
Yeah, that's right. And yeah, it was essentially art imitating life. And so former All-American Girls Professional Baseball League players recall those banged up knees and strawberries, which were those big red bruises. But as we sort of come to expect, from Philip Wrigley, the skirts were non-negotiable. It was Philip Wrigley's wife who designed them.
Oh, wow. Okay. Well, good for her.
I think similarly to that, actually, as well, just leading on from that, Prior to filming, the actresses trained with modern equipment, which was stronger and more durable than the gear they used, or the gear that they used in the real life professional league. And I don't know if they anticipated that they would switch to era appropriate equipment, but it obviously left its mark. And so just prior to filming, the cast began using mitts from the 1940s. And so like that would have felt so much different.
Yeah, right. Okay. I'm not as baseball fluent as you are, Jace, as we have well established over many podcasts now. I do know that not so much the equipment, but I know when they switched to era appropriate outfits and stuff like that, like they used the same materials and all that kind of.
Yeah.
It was just horribly uncomfortable. There's plenty of testimonies from plenty of actresses, even just extras that were in the movie, who said, you know, spending whole days in those uniforms that the girls had to wear back in the 40s and 50s was akin to torture.
Yeah, well, one of those actresses, Anne Ramsey, who plays Helen Haley, she actually had a ball slip through the old gloves' shoddy webbing and hit her in the face, breaking her nose.
Oh, wow. Hardcore.
We spoke about this actually at the start or prior to recording, Stewie, and we sort of likened it back to the Field of Dreams episode last week. The first ever night game at Wrigley Field, in the Field of Dreams episode last week, we sort of established that Wrigley Field was the last MLB stadium to get lights and play a game under lights. But that's not entirely true, as we have learned now. The first ever night game at Wrigley Field was actually an All-American Girls Professional Baseball League game. It doesn't really get a mention in the movie, but this league had an all-star game at the end of their first season, and they played it under portable lights at Wrigley Field.
Yeah, that's incredible. We were talking about it just prior to recording, and I had a hard time imagining it, but you seem to think that they were perhaps wheeled in on the top of generators or something like that.
Yeah, that's like the only possible explanation that I could find, that in terms of like, yeah, I think as you said at the time as well, you know, how they'd get lights that sort of were high enough and, you know, that you could sort of light up the whole field. So I think that, yeah, like there'd have to be some sort of structure, you know, big enough to get that height and then power it for, you know, 2-3 hours.
Yeah, yeah. It's a little factor that's lost to time a little bit, because wouldn't that predate any men's game being played under lights?
Yeah, probably, actually. Yeah, so right. It's not just resigned to Wrigley Field.
So, yeah, so the very first baseball game under lights. We'll put an asterisk on this one in case I'm way off base. See? Picking up on some baseball lingo. Mm-hmm. was actually played by the All-American Girls League and not the MLB. So that's interesting.
We'll just get on to, well, some of those rules now, Stewie. So
I do this every week.
Obviously, we had Kit's inside the park home run at the end of the movie, which effectively won the Bells the game and the World Series. And her bowling over Dottie. This was all well within the baseball rules up until only a few years ago. So if the catcher was in the way of you when you were running to home plate, you could bowl them over. And effectively, yeah, if they held onto the ball, you know, you were out. If they didn't, you weren't.
Why stop such a fantastic rule? That's great. That makes this game that's absolutely non-contact, just in this one instance, very much a contact sport.
Yeah, I think it was, obviously to avoid that contact. It was to give runners a proper running lane and so that they weren't impeded by, you know, just this big burly catcher in the way. Because, like, yeah, the idea is that, like, you know, you can't be in the way of a runner sort of, like, without the ball. Like, the ball can take you into that path and then it's just, like, sometimes a bit of an accidental collision, and sometimes you've got to like also allow to like for that sort of like space between you and the catcher, or you know, between catcher and runner. And so like you know, if you're rounding third and the catcher's sort of just like waiting for you at home plate already, like that's fine. But if it's like, you know, if it's just like neck and neck against each other and you just like sort of move into their way and bump them just as soon as they like reach the plate or about to, like a couple of steps away, I think that's more so frowned upon as well. So I think, yeah, I think the reason why they changed the rule was just to obviously avoid those collisions, because you did see a lot of players knocked out properly by those collisions.
Yeah, right. Okay.
But it was
safety reasons, yeah.
Yeah, but it was also to do with like the runners and their running path, and like even catchers, like they can you know, reach out, tag you, you know, off the base path as well. So they didn't really need to be standing there sort of like blocking you entirely.
Yeah.
So I think it was just a combination of all of those things.
Right. Okay. Interesting.
Another rule that I had a really like big problem with in this movie is that in one scene, I don't remember the character, but she caught the ball in her hat instead of her glove.
That was all the way, mate. That was Madonna that did that one.
There you go. I knew that you'd be yeah, so you can't actually catch a ball in your hat. So the ball has got to be caught in the glove or in the hand, and you've got to have control of the ball when it's in the glove or in the hand for it to be an out. And that's the same as if it was, you know, a catch. Like, say you like took a catch between your legs. Like, that's not a catch. It's got to be in your glove or in your hand. And so, like, you got to sort of, like, pop it out and hope that it gets in your glove. And, yeah, effectively, you can't use other sorts of equipment or clothing to get an out.
Nah, they need to change that. That's nonsense. Come on. How good did... How hard is this? Oh, I caught the ball, you know?
Yeah.
You're using your hat as you're falling backwards. That's just, that's player of the day business right there. What are they doing? They're robbing us of highlights. This is a bloody outrage. I'm writing a letter, a handwritten letter. That way they'll know I'm real serious.
All right, we'll now move on to looking at the cast list of this movie. And so I'll run you through a couple of them. Obviously, with the baseball team, you get introduced to so many characters, but I think that there were a couple that were at the forefront. And I know, Stewie, I know that you want to mention John Lovitz.
Listen, I'm doing my bit now. John Lovitz just comes in, right, and just... It's like he's the opening batter in a 2020 and it's professionals against amateurs. Every line out of his mouth is just six runs, just classics like pickle tickle. You see, the way it works is the train moves, not the station. When they're milking the cows, he goes, oh, it looks like he's enjoying that. That'd bruise me right up, he says.
Oh, doesn't that hurt them?
Doesn't seem to.
Well, that would bruise the hell out of me.
Oh, my God. Just the first 5 minutes, he just comes in and just... And then he's gone. He's gone for the entire movie. Just the mic drop and he's out of there. Just a fantastic 15, 20 minutes of just John Lovett killing it, man. He's just so funny. So funny. 10 out of 10.
No, he was good. He was good in his role as...
He was great. He was great. He wasn't just good. He was fantastic.
Sorry.
Anyway,
I'm sorry. He's wonderful in his role.
That's more like it. All right. Get more pumped up for John Lovitz.
All right. Well, we'll get pumped up for the other actors too then.
Absolutely. Yes. It's an all-timer.
We had Tom Hanks as Jimmy Duggan, who was the manager of the Rockford Peaches. We had Gina Davis as Dottie Hinson, who was the catcher slash assistant manager of the Peaches. We had Madonna as All the Way May, who was the center fielder. We had Laurie Petty as Kit Keller, who was the pitcher for the Peaches. And yeah, I think those were like the main four people that you sort of got used to in the movie. You had Rosie O'Donnell as Doris Murphy. You had Anne Ramsey as Helen Haley. Megan Kavanagh as Marla Hooch. And then obviously a couple of the other players as well. But apart from John Lovett, Stewie, is there anyone else that you want to single out and talk about their performance?
I can't remember if I said at the start of the podcast or if I said this off mic, but Tom Hanks, it was just on the precipice of one of the greatest acting runs of all time. Gina Davis, one of the most beautiful women in the world at the time, just classically beautiful. in this movie. She wouldn't have looked out of place in the Audrey Hepburn era, in my good opinion. Rosie O'Donnell, as likable as Rosie O'Donnell has ever been in her entire life, was her in this movie. She was fantastic. I enjoyed it. John Lovett's obviously brilliant. Laurie Petty, who plays Kit.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I already did my Kit is bit before, but, you know, she's fantastic, Laurie Petty. And she's actually said since, regardless of everything else that she's done, every time she's seen in public, she's just Kit from A League of Their Own. So that speaks volumes as well. I can't remember the other one that you mentioned. Oh, Madonna. Wow. Who knew she had this in her? She's just fantastic in this movie, Madonna. I can't speak highly enough about her. There's a bit of controversy. I'm not sure if this is on your side of the fence or mine.
Go for it.
There's a little bit of controversy with her being cast in the role. Deborah Winger, 80s starlet, was supposed to play Dottie Hinson, pulled out of the role. Did not want to have any part of it since if Madonna was going to be in it. So big loss for her, because who's Deborah Winger now? Everybody knows who the rest of these ladies are.
Fantastic. Just a little tidbit I've got about Tom Hanks. He almost didn't take the role
because he thought he was too young to play an avatar for Jimmy Fox, the Jimmy Dugan character. And one more thing. I'm not sure if it fits in here, but it's about Tom Hanks. There's no crying in baseball, right?
Hey, Evelyn, can I ask you a question? You got a moment?
Mm-hmm. Which team do you play for?
Well, I'm a peach.
Well, I was just wondering, because I couldn't figure out why you would throw home when we've got a two-run lead. You let the tying run get on second, and we lost the lead because of you. Now you start using your head. That's that love that's 3 feet above your ass!
Are you crying?
No.
Are you crying? Are you crying? There's no crying! There's no crying in baseball!
Why don't you leave her alone, Jimmy?
Oh, you zip it, Doris! Rogers Hornsby was my manager, and he called me a talking pile of pig shit. And that was when my parents drove all the way down from Michigan to see me play the game. And did I cry?
No.
No. No. No. And you know why?
No.
Because there's no crying in baseball. There's no crying in baseball. No crying.
Iconic line from this movie. The one line, when you mentioned it, straight away came to my head. There's no crying in baseball. Right?
Yep.
Ad-lib line. Wasn't part of the script.
Yeah.
Incredible. Absolutely incredible.
Nice.
Can't speak highly enough of this cast.
Yeah, I think just going back to that sort of Madonna controversy of her appearing in this movie and Deborah Winger's thoughts about it and why she walked away from this movie. I think that, Madonna or even just people around her went into film predominantly to sort of replicate what Elvis did. And so even Deborah Winger said she felt this was shaping up to be an Elvis film. Which obviously she's obviously remembered about, when Elvis made his foray into film. And obviously likened Madonna doing that in A League of Their Own as well. And so yeah, it's just really interesting to see what people's thoughts were about it.
Mm-hmm. And now Madonna's laughing all the way to the bank for many reasons, but A League of Their Own royalties is amongst them.
Yeah,
and I'm sure Deborah Winger, kicks herself every day because she thinks about she passed up on this smash hit film.
Yeah, absolutely. I think for me, in terms of the acting performances, I think that Tom Hanks sort of steals the show. I think they all do. I think that And again, I think that this has been reflective of a few of the movies that we've done. I think that every single character in these movies, they work so well together, such interchangeable in terms of their interactions with each other. Everyone can sort of demonstrate joyfulness. They can demonstrate sadness. And, look at, you know, those scenes like where they're like all happy about winning, and then like some of them have some infighting and they get really angry at each other. But then, like, you know, you have the scene where I can't remember the character's name, but she gets like a telegram to say that her husband has died in the war, and everyone like really comes and like supports her, and it just becomes this like somber mood as well. But like, I think that, yeah, I think that, like, as I said, like at the start, like this film like makes you feel so many things and like feel really connected. And I think that a lot of that is down to the actors as well. They just know how to come together, work together, and create a product like this. And so I think, yeah, that's a credit to Tom Hanks and Gina Davis in the first place. I mean, I think that their chemistry was really good together. Stewie, you have a little tidbit on just how much chemistry they were meant to have together.
So they're supposed to kiss. Yeah, it's in a deleted scene. You can find it on YouTube. If you buy it, it's in the extras. It's all there. Well, listen, I'm not going to hog it all because this was a joint thing. We both did the research here, mate. So they were supposed to kiss. In my opinion, it would have ruined the film. And you've got some cold, hard facts to back that one up, Jace.
Yeah, absolutely. I can back you up in that. And so I guess when this film was screened for former All-American Girls Professional Baseball League players, that scene actually upset a lot of them deeply. And so seeing a woman whose husband was away at war kiss another man, they said was out of character for one of them. And so the filmmakers heard them, they heard their advice, and the scene was cut from the final product.
Great call. It really would have ruined the Gina Davis character, Dottie Henson, because one of the cornerstones of her character is how in love she is with her husband, and she can't wait for him to come back, and she wants to go away and have a family and stuff. So, yeah. Although, if I can just go back, and this is just happening in real time, it really would have consolidated Dottie Henson as the villain of this film had she kissed Tom Hanks in this movie. So now I don't know what to think.
You still think Dottie's a villain? Yeah, and like, I mean, you touched on it as well. I think Madonna was really good. I don't think, like, if you were just watching this as like a one-off movie, had no idea who she was at all, I would say, like, you would think that she was, you know, a film star in her own right. I think that that's how well she portrayed herself on the screen, played the character of May. And yeah, I think that, yeah, if you were to view this movie just by itself, you would think of Madonna as a film star instead of a singer, as she's more commonly known. And so I think that's just a testament to her. Obviously, yeah, just her wanting to make a career in film. And having this movie sort of pave that way at the start. And obviously she's focused on her singing more so as well. But I think, yeah, it was good to sort of see where she sort of came from with film. And so I think that she did really well with that. And yeah, I think that all it comes back to for me is just like the chemistry between all these characters. They do so well with everything coming together.
Yep. Fantastic chemistry between the entire cast.
One point that I want to finish on as well is just like Gina Davis, and then we also had Laurie Petty, so as Dottie and Kit. I think that their chemistry was really good, and it needed to be really good, I think, just because they were obviously playing sisters and they wanted to properly convey that. I think that they definitely did that at all times, that when you saw them together as sisters and then saw them as rivals as well. I think that regardless of what side you saw their relationship, I think that they encapsulated that sort of sisterly bond more so. And that was just like, you know, that sort of, just that aspect of those two characters, that they were able to come back to that sisterly bond. And I think we saw that at the end as well. I think that when they were getting on the buses, on their respective buses, you know, at the start of the movie, we saw Kit sort of swinging for the higher ones, and Dottie saying, lay off them.
Look, sis, she's getting everybody out high. Don't swing at that pitch, okay?
You can hit it.
You can't.
I can.
This bat's too heavy. You're never going to get it around.
I will.
Kit, listen. There's a big pole on the right side, okay? Don't look. Well, if she pitches inside, you're going to have to pull it, okay?
I know.
Run her up.
No high ones.
I like the high ones. Mule, Ned.
And we had a similar sort of sequence or similar sorts of comments as they were leaving on their buses. And so I think that it was really cool to have that sort of come full circle. And I'll reference another one of our previous films that we've done on this podcast as well, Double Teamed. I find it similar to that. That film was about two sisters playing basketball, and they had a bit of a rivalry as they were trying to get a place on the team. And they were saying, oh, you're second best. And I think that, yeah, in that movie at the end, as they're tipping off on opposite teams, they say that quote to each other again. And so I liken it to that. I think that, yeah, for movies to come around full circle like that, especially in terms of familial relationships, I think that is really cool to see.
Absolutely. And it's kind of evidence of a story well told as well.
Looking at like the film or, you know, that 1988 scene, those 1998 scenes where you see the older versions of these characters, I think that they did actually, and like you obviously saw them watching a game of softball with, I think, former All-American Girl Professional Baseball League players as well.
Mm-hmm.
I know of one person in that particular team of the Rockford Peaches who were at that field was actually a former player in that league from 1949 to 1951. So Shirley Berkovich played Alice Gaspers, who was one of the players. And so, yeah, Shirley Berkovich played older Alice. And so I don't know if any of the other ones who played older versions of these characters were former players either, but definitely Shirley was. And so I think that was really cool to see because, like, yeah, I was thinking, like, when I saw her name, I was like, oh, you know, it was Lynn Cartwright as older Dottie. Was she, like, a former baseball player? And, yeah, just wondering about all the others, but I definitely know of that one.
Yeah, you do have to say that Penny Marshall and whoever the casting director was, you know, just with those little things, particularly with the African American girl as well, I can't remember her name. She really did a great job of paying homage to some stars of women's baseball past.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, Stewie, was there any character that you saw throughout this movie that you could relate to in any way, whether it was the character themselves, a characteristic of them, or maybe it was just a line that the character said?
Okay. This will probably come as a shock. Well, some of it might shock people, but my main point will come as a shock to no one. I'm sober. I have been sober for 5 years, completely teetotaler. I don't drink at all. But when I used to drink, I used to have quite the smart mouth, a lot like John Lovett's character at the start of the movie. I always had to have the last word. I always had a smart ass comment. So yeah, young Stewie was a lot like Ernie Cappadino. That's who I related to quite a lot. And yeah, just some classic one-liners there. So yeah.
I think mine might be Ira Lowenstein. And so we haven't really talked about him. He was played by David Strathairn, I believe is how you pronounce his name. He was the one that was put in charge of this women's league in the first place by Walter Harvey. And he was the one that sort of like brought the idea to light, made sure it happened. And then even when Walter Harvey was like, oh, well, this league won't be anymore after this first season, you know, we'll have people coming back from the war and all this now. Yeah, I think just like his responses to all of that from Harvey saying, you know, we won't need them again. Just sort of Ira sort of standing up for himself and saying, you know, I sold your product when there was no product. This is now a product. Let me take over. I think you're wrong. I'm going to prove it to you. I think that, yeah, him standing up for that, I really like. And, you know, I think that it's a bit reflective of like today as well. Like, you know, you have like so many commentators online commentators say that sort of stuff about women's sports. And so you definitely need those people who are willing to stick up for them. And, you know, I'd like to think that I'm one of those people. And so, yeah, I found myself or like his comments, especially in that particular scene be really reflective of sort of like how I would expect myself to act in that certain way, or, you know, how I would sort of see or want other people to sort of respond to the comments like that.
Absolutely. As is tradition in this segment, I've gone for a very funny thing and you've gone for a very meaningful thing, Jason. So I'm glad to see that tradition continues.
All right. Well, we're getting to the end of the episode now, Stewie. So we asked the question, if you could have a baseball movie get made, what would it be and why?
Okay, mate. Listen, I've done baseball specifically many, many, many times, Jace, okay? So I've done a bit of a bend on this one. Reality TV show, okay?
Okay.
You take recently retired MLB greats.
Yeah.
You put them in era-appropriate All-American Girls League outfits, and you have them play and train in a charity baseball game against each other. Just shits and gigs. Just to watch them suffer the way that the girls suffered back in the 40s. And, you know, raise some money for charity at the same time.
I love it.
I'm an ideas man. Not always good ideas, Jace, but I have ideas.
No, that's cool. I'm really like kicking myself a little bit for having my Genevieve Beckham story idea. I think it was last week or maybe a little while ago now, because I think that would fit perfectly with this one. But I have found another one. I've related it to women's baseball as well, as is the theme of this movie. And that's just baseball, women's baseball on a more of a world stage. And so it'd be through the Women's Baseball World Cup. It was founded in 2004. There's one every single year. There were 12 teams in 2018. Obviously, there was not one in 2020. And so I believe there'd be one in 2022 this year. But anyway, so it's contested by 12 teams. Japan have won the title 6 consecutive times. So from 2008 to 2018. But basically, yeah, so it's played by countries all over the world, including Australia. And so I think just like having, I always like to relate it to like the first part of a competition on like, you know, just the rise of women's baseball and how it properly puts itself and places itself onto the world stage. And so I'd look at that and then just, yeah, see how far it's come.
Absolutely. I think that's a great idea. I love a World Cup movie, not baseball related. But one of my favorite movies of all time, little known movie, soccer movie, shock horror. It's called Mike Bassett, England Manager. Mm-hmm. And maybe we can do it in preparation for the World Cup, Jason. It's a good time.
Okay. Yeah, let's do that.
Yeah, love a World Cup movie. Hey, this I've got a question before we roll on to the next bit, Jace.
Yeah.
Is Australia gonna win the Women's Baseball World Cup first? Or the Women's Soccer World Cup first?
Women's Soccer World Cup, most definitely.
Okay. I'm not educated enough to answer that question because I know nothing about women's baseball in Australia. Well,
So Australia, their best placing at the Women's Baseball World Cup is second. That was in
2000. Oh, so we made a final.
Yeah.
Right. Okay.
Lost to Japan. That was the second of their 6 consecutive titles.
Mm-hmm.
We also won a bronze in 2014.
Okay. Gotcha. So is that where we sit right now in that, you know, just beneath the elite?
I would say now maybe like in the sort of like 5th to 6th place. So just out of those sort of like finals.
Mm-hmm. So we're in the chasing pack.
Yeah, we haven't made finals for the past 2 iterations of this tournament.
Okay, fascinating.
All right, Stewie, we have come to the end of the episode now. So would you like to share your social media handles with us and any other platform where we can find you?
Absolutely. After Extra Time is back, baby, for season 22-23. We just did our week 1 recap, which will probably go live similar time to Goals on Film. So get yourself a bit of a Stewie double and listen to Goals on Film and then chuck on After Extra Time. Hear me and Paul, who guested last week, chat about soccer. Also, you can find me at Stewie is Sick of It on Twitter and at Stewie the Sports Guy on Instagram and TikTok. I don't do TikToks, but I might. I might start doing them with my cat. What you do get if we follow each other on TikTok is I will send you endless amounts of hilarious TikToks to the point where you're thinking, why did I ever add this guy? So you've got all that to look forward to, mate. Jace, where can we hear you and where can we find you?
Well, maybe that's why I don't have you on TikTok yet, Stuart.
That's why a lot of people don't have me on TikTok, mate.
But you can find me on both Twitter and Instagram at Jace Irves. You've been listening to Goals on Film. You can find Goals on Film on Twitter and Instagram at Goals on Film Pod. Goals on Film is part of the Edge of the Crowd network. You can find Edge of the Crowd on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, LinkedIn, YouTube, and TikTok at Edge of the Crowd. You can also view any of our stories, be it sport, culture, or politics, on our website, www.edgeofthecrowd.com. Thanks for listening, and we'll catch you next week.